supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Secretary of Education Arne Duncan says the goal is to stimulate innovation while the policy is being debated in Washington. In sports, the Phils have a doubleheader against the Mets today in New York. Cole Hamels heads to the mound at 1:10. R.A. Dickey pitching for the Mets, and Joe Blanton will get the start for Game 2. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, 'tis the season for home-invading insects to gather on the outside of your house trying to move in with you. Stink bugs have become pervasive at this in the Northeast, but there's lots of other insects who do this all over the country. We'll teach you some neat tricks to trap them outside before they can get in, and then how to collect them easily indoors if they do get past your defenses. You won't want to miss it. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Arlena, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for all your wonderful information.
Well, aren't you sweet? And where are you?
Havertown, Pennsylvania.
Excellent. What can we do for Arlena in Havertown?
I have a dinner plate hibiscus. It's a perennial. I've had it for many years. And this year, about probably 2 months ago, I noticed that it was developing these weird, you know, veiny things all over the leaves. So I took it into a local nursery, and it was diagnosed with leaf miners.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't then see any bugs. At this point, the leaves now have little holes all over them, and I did notice...
Ha! Excellent!
Yeah. Little teeny tiny white dots that might be some sort of insect. I don't know. But anyway, the leaves are all... holy at this point. It did flower nicely, and I'm getting a few second, but the second ones aren't coming out so well.
Yeah, well, it's late in the game, honey.
Right,
let's be
late.
Honest here.
Yes, it is. But anyway, they recommended some, you know, some chemical salts or whatever, and it's also near squash, so I certainly didn't want to be putting anything in the ground. And I looked on your website, and I didn't see anything for hibiscus. I did see, I think, for boxwood or something, but I wasn't sure if it was the same recommendation. So
many, many years ago, back when this show was just starting, I had a guy on, and I forget what his topic was, but I was growing columbine for one of the first times. And my columbine was beautiful, but I had leaf miners, which, for people who don't know what they are, they're insects that crawl inside the leaves where they're totally protected, and then they make these very distinctive roadmap-like trails.
Yes,
through,
and I do have them in my columbine.
Throughout the leaves. The columbine leaf miner is famous. It's almost impossible to grow columbine for long periods of time without it showing up.
Okay.
And I was talking about this with him, and he got really huffy, because I guess I had been yelling at him about using chemicals in these and stuff. And he goes, well, you don't have to do anything because you're an organic gardener. And I wasn't even sure I was following them. But then he proceeded to say that leaf miners are invulnerable to chemical insecticides, but there are dozens of beneficial insects that have perfected the method of going in after them. And he said there is not in our area, a leaf miner is never safe. It's just a question of having a nice, clean garden with a lot of pollinators and beneficial insects. And I would suggest that the holes you're seeing in your leaves are the entry points that the Marines are using take out your leaf miners. They never came back on my columbine. Exactly what he said was true. By the end of the season, the beneficial insects had found them, devoured them. And then they probably set up a little camp just in case they had something good to eat the next year, but they didn't. I forget what I wrote for boxwood leaf miners. It's just so long ago, and that's a very different kind of plant. Obviously, that's a plant that's going to look the same in winter as it does in spring and summer. But I would urge you to follow the indirect method. Next season, you know, actually right now, I want you to go out and buy some pansies.
Okay.
And plant them around your leaf-minored plants.
Okay.
And maybe put some spring bulbs in later. It's too early to plant spring bulbs now, but after we get past Halloween, put some spring bulbs in the ground, especially tiny ones, little things like species, tulips, or crocuses. And then next season, as soon as it's safe to put herbs out, put some flowering herbs in that area as well.
All right.
And then for the kicker, get a couple of little dishes that have chips or something in them that are cracked. Fill them with pebbles, fill them with water, and leave them in that area. That will attract the maximum number of beneficial insects. The beneficial insects that prey on these kind of pest insects are so small they can't get a drink of water from conventional sources. They would drown. So we fill little containers with pebbles.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And then put some water on so these pebbles. Little tiny insects can perch on the pebbles, get a little drink of water, and then go eat your leaf miners for you. The best gardens, the healthiest gardens, are the ones with the most diverse plants in them. There's almost no plant that's ever wrong to have out there. The only mistake you can make is not diversifying, growing everything together, having limited numbers of plants, because then you risk not bringing in the insects who are the biggest help.
All right.
Next year, plant lots more basil. That's a great plant. Any small flowered herb is perfect for this. Dill, tansy, things like that. And let the extra ones flower.
Okay. All right. I will do that.
All right.
All right. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. You have a good time.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine today, Mayor. How are you?
I'm great.
And
I'm great
where?
In Muncie, Indiana.
Excellent. You beat me to the punch there. Mary in Muncie. What can we do for Mary in Muncie?
I know that you usually recommend pruning in the spring, but I've always been a person that thought trees and bushes should be planted in the fall. And I wanted to plant a dwarf peach tree, and as I was reading about it, everything I was reading also recommended I wait until spring.
Really?
So I thought I'd call you and find out what you thought.
Well, I don't know that I recommend pruning in the spring. I do warn against pruning in the fall, because nothing should be pruned in the fall. But we're talking about planting. Now, you have obtained said peach tree?
No, I was beginning to look for a tree, and when I read that, I stopped and thought I better find out more before I went ahead and bought the tree.
So you were going to buy it mail order?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, see, the truth there is the companies that sell these plants mail order only ship them in the spring.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with the planting time of the tree. I will tell you that when I finally caved in and bought peach trees for my wife, they were delivered that spring. But that was the spring of a giant cicada emergence.
Mm-hmm.
And I was afraid that they would damage these young fruit trees, which is the only agricultural damage they do. So I healed them into big recycling tubs and giant containers and then planted them in the fall, knowing that fall is a much better time in general for plant survival than spring for planting long-lived plants like trees and shrubs.
Okay.
So if you could find a peach tree now, I would urge you to plant a peach tree now.
Okay.
Have you ever grown tree fruits before?
I grew up on a farm. We did a number of fruits. And my mom actually did plant a small grove of dwarf trees, but she tended more to the rest of her garden instead of the trees, so the trees never produced much. So this is rather new for me, too.
Right. You have to be aware that peach trees are probably the most difficult thing to grow.
Okay.
They do need to be pruned every winter. The fruits, as they develop, must be thinned. You must remove at least half of the developing fruits. Better to remove 3/4. And then every pest and disease in the world wants a piece of these peaches. You know, stink bugs, brown rot, the list goes on. It is, but of course, very few things taste better.
right.
Second, I'll warn you, although people are willing to sell you dwarf peach trees, there's precious few true dwarf peach trees. It's much easier to dwarf an apple tree than it is a peach. Most of the time, you'll see the more truthful semi-dwarf, which means it's going to get pretty honking big. But you, these things grow so lushly, you can cut them back and keep them at the right height you want during their annual pruning. And you're always going to get more peaches with more than one tree. They need morning sun, morning sun, morning sun. They need great airflow. They need a lot of sunshine. They need you not to go on vacation during flowering time and thinning time and harvest time. They are not easy. Raspberries are easy fruits. Peaches are very demanding, but they are also incredibly rewarding. And again, if you can get this tree or these trees and plant them this fall, the survival rate is much better than the spring, although spring is the traditional time to plant fruit trees, simply because that's when they're in the nurseries and that's when the mail order companies are gearing up to ship out their stock.
Okay. Well, I very much appreciate it.
All right. Good luck. What do you think you're going to do?
I think I will try and find one or two dwarf peach trees, and if not, then I'll wait until spring.
Okay, very good. Look for disease resistance.
Look
for that to be mentioned specifically in the description, and make sure you plant them in the spot in your landscape that gets the first and most morning sun.
Okay.
All right, good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all tomato growers in climes similar to mine that the time has come to pull off any new flowers that appear on your plants. Yeah, boo-hoo. But those flowers don't have a chance of turning into full-size fruits before frost comes, and it'll greatly help the tomatoes you already have ripen up to pull off those flowers promptly. But don't you go pulling your pistols just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to keep stink bugs, box elder bugs, and other home-invading insects out of your house. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to WHYY.
People's Light and Theater supports WHYY and presents the return of Don Quixote, now through October 16th. Don Quixote is shaken from his boring yet respectable retirement when his old companion Sancho Panza shows up with an unauthorized biography that makes a mockery of their past escapades. What else can the friends do but hit the road again? A charming tale to remind us that romance and adventure hide around every corner, if we are brave enough to look. For information, 610-644-3500 or peopleslight.org.
Supporting WHYY, Athena Health. Helping physicians secure meaningful use and other quality incentives while focusing on delivering patient care. More about their cloud-based EHR and practice management services is at athenahealth.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Well, last winter, too many of us in the Northeast shared our indoor space with hibernating stink bugs. Kept coming out to say hello, try to tell us they didn't like what we had on TV. In other parts of the country, it was box elder bugs or conifer seed bugs. They're just all over the place. Well, when we get to the question of the week, we'll tell you about two simple traps that can either keep them out of your house or catch them when they get inside. You won't want to miss it. In the meantime, though, lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Elizabeth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Elizabeth. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, except I'm inundated with rabbits.
And where is inundated Elizabeth?
Thousand Oaks, California, Conejo Valley.
So tell me what's going on.
Well, they are literally all over. They're all over the front yard, the backyard, the garden, every place you look. And they drop wherever they pass, so you can't have your pets there because the pets will eat that, and it's not good for them.
There's something wrong with rabbit poop for pets?
Yes, there is. They get very ill.
Really? I know it's a good fertilizer.
It's not good for pets.
Huh. Okay, so what kind of a situation are we talking about? You have a suburban home in landscape, rural, city?
I do. I have a suburban home, and it's landscaped. And when I tell you there's 20 rabbits on the grass at a time, there's 20 rabbits at a time.
Hey, wait a minute now, Elizabeth. You're talking about pets.
We're talking about an invasion, Mike.
Now, I know, but you're talking about having pets that are outside, and you're having rabbits. Why is there not an equal sign between your pets and a lowering of the rabbit population?
Rabbits do not respect any boundary, and the pet that we had, we lost. And when we lost him, part of the problem was because of the poop he'd eaten.
So it was a dog?
It was just kind of a mutt.
Almost every breed of dog I can think of would prey upon rabbits, to put it bluntly.
Our dog was a sissy.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, were you to replace this dog with a Jack Russell Terrier, I would think that the problem would be solved.
Well, we don't have the whole property fenced. We have almost an acre.
Right.
And we don't have it all fenced. And the rabbits are all over. They're in the front, the sides, the yard, everywhere.
Rabbits can do a tremendous amount of agricultural damage. People think of them as these cute little fuzzy creatures, but they are second only to deer in their ability to actually change a landscape for the worst, you know, just level it. So traditionally, they're kept under control by predators. In your area, like coyotes and foxes or domestic animals. I'm familiar with the eastern cottontail. Are these cottontails as well? Because I know out west you have a variety of rabbit species we do not have here. Do yours dig burrows at all?
They do a little bit. I don't see a lot of that. Mostly I just see them on the green.
Yeah, so they're probably cottontails or have the same habits. We had a guy on the show not long ago who explained that even so-called burrowing rabbits in the United States typically just take over other animals' dens when they die or move away. Well, I can tell you that installing a very simple fence, a few inches in the ground and a foot above ground, would keep them out because they don't have a lot of capability. They can't climb, and it sounds like your rabbits are the non-digging type. A fence buried a few inches in the ground would be all that would be needed to keep them out. And you may want to consider fencing at least dedicated areas.
What would I use for the fencing material?
Rabbit fence. Anything that you can go out and buy. Rabbit fence itself is welded wire, sold to people who raise rabbits professionally. But it has the right heft to it. It has the right spacing. It's a welded metal, so it would hold up.
Okay.
And use tin snips or have an industrial cutter cut it to the length you need, because most rabbit fencing is going to be 4 or 5 feet tall. You could get a roll of it and have it cut into 3 sections. You could cover a lot of territory and then pound it into the ground. And, you know, we're not talking about groundhogs or anything big. You really wouldn't even have to stake it that much. Just make it 1.5 feet tall, drive it 6 inches into the ground, have 1 foot above ground. You can just step right over it. That would be a good start.
Okay.
In municipal situations, they generally do trapping, not poisoning. You do not want to ever poison an animal, especially in a location like yours, because then what happens is a raptor or some other good predator eats the poisoned animal, and you get to kill one rabbit, and you get to kill one coyote or hawk that would have killed thousands of rabbits.
Right.
But trapping can be very effective. You just have to keep up with it. A lot of people would hire a trapper to take care of the traps and dispose of the animals humanely. But really, the old school farm answer is to have a couple of Jack Russell Terriers, have a couple of barn cats, and let that kind of unnatural nature take its course. With terriers, for instance, with the dogs, typically all you do is you install one of these invisible fencing systems underground, and that keeps the dog on your property. But they would run right up to that property line, and they would chase and or prey upon any rabbits they came upon. It's just in their nature. Those are the three cures. Fencing, which is unobtrusive and inexpensive type of fencing. Fencing off dedicated areas first to try it out, see how it works. Trapping, and then either feisty barn cats or a dog like a Jack Russell Terrier, some sort of guardian dog who's used to...
What about the spigots that shoot water when they hit your land? They automatically go off?
Rabbits are just so low to the ground. You could keep them away from an area close to your house, but I don't think it would be as effective as against deer coming in occasionally, especially with the numbers you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think we're back to fencing, traps, and domestic animals who would prey upon them.
Okay.
All right?
Thank you.
All right, good luck.
Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Peter, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Good day, Mike.
Good day, Peter. How are you, sir?
Very well.
And where is Peter very well?
I am from Chester Springs, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Peter in Chester Springs?
Yes, we had approximately a 30 by 30 vegetable and flower garden that we've had for the last 15 years. And this summer, this spring, we decided to turn the entire garden into raised beds. And in fact, we're left with two perennial plants within the garden that I wanted to find out what we could do with. First are our asparagus plants and our raspberry bushes. And I was wondering if, in fact, we would be able to put wooden edging around those and over a number of years add 6 to 8 inches of soil to both of those beds. So, in fact, I'm able to then put gravel and other material around my beds within the garden to keep the weeds down.
So the raised beds that are built.
Yes,
they are
raised
built.
Beds are built.
And they are no more than 4 feet wide.
That's correct, and 8 feet long.
And excellent, and they got 2-foot walking lanes in between them.
They do.
Okay. The asparagus, is that in a defined area?
It is. It's not defined other than the walking paths around it. There are no raised beds or anything that are confining any root from pushing outside that area.
Asparagus, although it can get excitable, asparagus is much better behaved than raspberries, which,
yes.
You know, of course, is not saying much. I have visited many people whose asparagus beds have been boxed off in some way or another, kind of to define them, kind of to, like, let the people know when little Gumby and Pokey were wandering outside the block. You know, so they could harvest them first, so to speak. But there's no harm in boxing off your asparagus to define it. I don't know that I would want to be adding, like, the massive amounts of soil you were talking about. It would be good to add, like, an inch of compost to your boxed-in asparagus bed once a year, maybe for 3 years in a row, but that's as high as I'd want to take it, and that'll give you enough of a barrier that you can keep weeds down. Gravel is not a good weed deterrent. The gravel prevents you from weed whacking, unless you want to break every window in your home and car and, you know, go in bruised from head to toe. In between lanes of a raised bed is a great place for wood mulch. Or just let the weeds grow, weed whack them, and use the green matter for your compost. It's, you know, it's not rocket science. The raspberries are not going to be restrained. But I have raspberries that kind of coexist with raised beds, and they should not be boxed in. That's just kind of a joke. They would just take that as kind of a challenge, and they would just, like, walk through your electric fence. The thing you'll want to do is just keep an eye on the new shoots in the beginning of the season when raspberry shoots come up in raised beds where you want something else. Just pull them up and move them back into the area where you kind of hope your raspberries will stay. That's not an area that is going to be confined or defined or do anything you want it to. Raspberries kind of go where they want. But early in the spring, especially if it's a nice rainy day, they are so easy to transplant. You can dig them up with a shovel. You can pull them up slowly, take them back to where they belong, replant them. You won't miss a step.
Great. Thank you. That's very helpful.
All right, man. Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Charles, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Charles. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm fine. I love this Philadelphia weather, and in Germantown, we're staying warm.
Okay, so you're in the Germantown section of Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
All right, what can we do for Charles in Germantown?
Well, my neighbor and I are having taken down a cherry tree. It's probably four stories high.
Okay.
At least 18, 20 years old. Once we have it taken down, do we need to do more than just having the arborist grind as deeply as he can, grind it away? Do we have to take the exposed portion there and drill in it, add those dreadful things that you talk against, chemicals to destroy the roots? Because the roots have been working their way into our home and our cellar.
Okay, so this is why the tree is being taken down.
Absolutely.
Okay. Stump killers don't work. It's not a question of whether I'm against them or not. They've been tested at universities. They just don't work. Yes, they are chemicals. They tend to be very high concentrations of nitrogen, and they're absolutely useless. So, yes, you're adding chemicals to your environment, and you're not improving the situation.
Okay, so I'm trying to avoid taking up a whole slab of concrete paving that things have gone under.
Well,
and trying to avoid the added cost of trying to pull that stump out.
Here's the deal. By cutting the top of the tree down, you will certainly slow down the growth. You may get some suckers coming up from the roots, the tree trying to regrow itself, but taking the tree down will kill it, and the roots will slowly stop growing. Certainly, they will not do any more destruction. They will simply mostly remain there in stasis. So you have two issues. Were you to leave some portion of the trunk up, that's nice for wildlife. Were you to leave like a couple inches of the trunk up, then you could box that area off and build a raised bed over top of it. Plant nice annual flowers, even a vegetable garden in that raised bed. And the process of feeding and watering those plants and keeping that soil wet would actually accelerate the decomposition of the stump faster than any chemical you could pour in it. But you will never actually be able to grow another tree there, you realize, or anything like that, because you're leaving this giant plug in the ground.
Right.
And
yeah,
the roots.
We don't want to grow another tree.
And the roots will sprout mushrooms throughout your lawns. As the wood in the roots tries to return to soil, it needs the help of fungal bodies. And when these fungal bodies, these mycelium, colonize the underground wood, they're going to make themselves known by the above-ground fruiting structures that we call mushrooms. So anytime a tree's roots are left in the ground, you're going to have mushrooms pop up until those roots decompose, which is a process that takes decades. But the roots will no longer be trying to get into your downstairs bathrooms and stuff.
Right. Well, that's the good part.
And I have to be honest, in most situations I tell people to go for the extra and have the stump pulled. But when you got houses all around with foundations and an old tree, it's pretty dicey. What I would recommend, if the neighbors were to go for it, is a modified stump pulling. That's to trench really deeply all around the trunk in all directions and then pull out that one giant plug, leaving the lateral roots that are making their way towards the houses. Then you can fill in that area, reseed it, and have what you want. But the cheap way out, and it's not bad, is don't grind the stump all the way down. Leave a little bit, box it off, make sure there's at least good 6 inches of compost and soil on top of it, and then use that growing box as if that was always your idea, to have a big, beautiful, raised bed in the middle of this area.
Okay. That gives me some thoughts that had never occurred to me. I didn't know anything about trenching.
The trenching thing is something I stupidly discovered accidentally doing cowboy gardening. I had to get rid of the roots of an old Christmas tree that we had planted and then harvested to use as a Christmas tree again many years later, an outdoor tree that we took in indoors for its like final year of life. And I realized, well, wait a minute. You know, now I got this big root system in this and this trunk in the ground. So God help me, I took a chainsaw with an old chain that couldn't be sharpened anymore, and I just dug, you know, trenched around this thing as far as I would go, sparks flying up all over the place. God, it was dangerous. But then I just grabbed a hold of the trunk, and the whole thing came out, and it was great. And I wasn't dead. I still had both arms and everything. It was very exciting.
I'll try and talk my arborist into the trenching.
Yes, because they have the real tools to do it.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I'm glad you like the trenching idea. Don't do it the way I did it. Make sure they use the right tools. And good luck, Charles.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care, sir.
Peace.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and urge everybody out there who hasn't done it already to plant a flat of pansies for fall and winter color and edible flowers that fight varicose and spider veins. Plant garlic for harvest next summer. Plant runs of lettuce and spinach for the finest flavored fall salads. But not to prune anything or plant spring bulbs. Bulb time is coming soon, so just hold on to your hyacinths. But proper pruning time is long off. So hide the shears, Sheila! But don't you go pulling the pruners out of those helpful hands just yet, because we'll be right back with how to trap stink bugs and other home invaders before they get into your house and even after. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden. It's 11:38. Checking the garden calendar for today. We've got an important note for you. The country picnic at Lower Gwynedd has been canceled for today. Mike was to have given a fall gardening lecture at 1:30, but again, the country picnic and lecture have been canceled because of the weather and field conditions. Otherwise, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society Big Fall Festival, which is free, continues until 4 today at the Navy Yard. And the Highlands Mansion and Gardens in Fort Washington holds its annual craft fair garden restoration fundraiser next Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 4 each day. For more information, check out the events section of youbetyourgarden.org. Also, this reminder, Brad Pitt joins us on today's Fresh Air Weekend. Pitt's starring in the new film Moneyball. Also, Maurice Sendak, famous for his children's books, Where the Wild Things Are, and In the Night Kitchen, will be along on Fresh Air Weekend. He'll reflect on growing old and losing the people he loves. Fresh Air comes your way at 1 today here on WHYY. Also, this reminder, WHYY's October membership drive begins on the 13th, and you can listen pledge free on YStream. For details, visit whyy.org/YStream. WHYY forecast for today, overcast for the most part with the chance for showers and mild, the high today about 77.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. One that you'll find interesting if you have stink bugs trying to come indoors, box elder bugs trying to move in with you, or any of the other home-invading insects that can make your wintertime miserable inside. We'll tell you how to make a simple trap that'll catch them outside and how to get a trap that will catch them inside so you don't have to get your hands all dirty and stinky. And that's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I love your show.
Why, thank you, Andrew. I love that you love my show. Where are you, man?
I live in Trenton, New Jersey.
Trenton makes, the world takes.
That's right.
What can we do for Andrew in Trenton?
Well, Mike, I've decided to reseed my lawn. It's not a large area. It's a roughly 1,500 square feet. So I decided to rototill and in preparation for complete reseeding. And I did that about a month ago. I rototilled the yard and gave it a thorough raking. And I got out about 90% of the weeds. To be honest, there's still a few maverick weeds there.
That's fine. That's fine. So far, so good.
Okay. And then I used, just with a hand spreader, I used a fertilizer, something called seed starter.
Why? Oh, because somebody told you to, and you bought into it.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That was your first mistake.
Okay. Then after that, I raked that in, and then I seeded the lawn. But then about a week later, Irene hit and washed away a good bit of the seed.
Mm-hmm.
The grass is coming up this week, but it's coming up in spots, in areas, like little islands.
What kind of seed did you use? What variety?
I believe it is a fescue.
Okay. You need to go back and get some more. Now, let me tell you the three things you did wrong.
Okay.
You started out good. You seized defeat from the jaws of victory, however.
Okay.
You tilled while it was dry. That was good.
Yes.
And then you raked away most of the green stuff.
Right.
Then you're supposed to put down an inch of compost or screened topsoil to make a naturally fertile seed bed, which you did not do.
Okay. No, I didn't do that.
One of the other things you can also do, because you had started so far in advance, is you could have leveled the ground after you tilled it up, watered it, left it alone for 10 days, and then hoed the weeds at the soil surface with a sharp hoe. That would have gotten rid of all your weeds.
Okay.
Then you put down compost or rich screen topsoil, and then you sow the seed in it. Starter fertilizer only limits the amount of seed that will germinate. It's a harsh chemical fertilizer. It's chemical salts. It's the same high explosives that are being used to make roadside bombs against our troops.
Oh, my God.
But what you should have done was put down some organic matter and then sowed your seed in that. Now, it's not too late. What I would suggest is you find yourself a good source of compost. I know there's tons of municipal compost in your area in New Jersey.
Okay.
And spread it on top of what you have now.
About, even if the grass, even if the seeds are starting to germinate?
Yes.
Okay. Broadcast that. Okay.
Yes. About an inch thick, and then go get exactly the same seed. You're stuck now. You need to always be able to buy that seed to match the blade shape and blade color. And then I want you to overseed another run of that same fescue into your nice organic seed bed inch of soil that you've spread around.
Okay.
That should help out. By choosing a fescue, you chose a grass that will be a little bit more low care. You won't have to water it as often. You won't have to feed it as often.
Okay.
You only get to cut it short once. When your new lawn comes up and it's 2 inches high, you can give it a cutting.
All right.
After that, you're never cutting it below 3 inches. 3.5 inches would be even better. So every couple of falls, it's going to be very natural that you'll need to get some more compost, spread it around, and put some more seed in there. That would be the case no matter what with a fescue.
No matter what. Okay, good. Okay, that's great advice, Mike. Thank you.
All right, Andrew. Good luck, man.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Niraj, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing...
Thank you very much for your informative program. We appreciate that.
Why, thank you. Where are you, man?
Penn Valley on the suburb of Philadelphia.
Very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, a company that takes care of my lawn for the last 2 years, last year they used some form of compound. They call it Earth Life. With, of course, they use it with the seeding. And when I asked what is this called, what is this substance, they said it is a ground mulch with some form of broken down sludge that they get it from New Jersey. It seems to me it worked well last year, and now he's going to do the same thing again this year. My question is, what is this material, which we don't see it in Home Depot or similar places?
That's right, that's right. Well, you know, when you use the porcelain commodity room in your home, Raj, after dinner, when you wake up in the morning, and then you flush that stuff away.
Right.
Well, that goes to a water treatment plant, and the water treatment plant breaks down the solids. And the solids are then sold to, like, landscapers and companies. And so there may be a little bit of you out on your lawn there. A sewage sludge, which is also known as biosolids, so that it sounds better to people, is the residue left behind from water treatment plants. It's an interesting product in that technically it should be okay to use. And human waste, with a couple of disease concerns, is an excellent agricultural fertilizer. The problems occur because, you know, in America, we're heavily medicated. We are more heavily medicated with prescription drugs than probably every other nation in the world combined. And these birth control hormones, these antibiotics, all of these crazy drugs, they survive to a great degree the water treatment process, and they can be found in that sewage sludge.
Wow.
But of course, the big danger, as you can imagine, it, you know, sometimes I'll go past an auto store and I'll see these change your own oil specials. You know, it's like 4 quarts of oil, 5 quarts of oil in a filter. And every once in a while I'll ask them, do you demand that they bring the old oil back? And they go, no, no, but we'll recycle it for them for an extra $10. So, you know, everybody who's changing their own oil is pouring it into the ground or a river or down the toilet. And every day we hear these horror stories about people who are supposed to handle toxic waste responsibly just pouring it into the sewer system. So what happens is a lot of times this stuff gets contaminated. And so I can tell you that sewage sludge is not allowed for use in organic agriculture.
So this is not like decomposed cow manure that you buy from the store.
Correct. It is not. The best bulk organic material to add to your lawn would be real compost. Compost made from fall leaves. Many municipalities, I'm not sure of your area, take the fall leaves and the lawn trimmings and the garden trimmings of their residents and turn it into rich, beautiful black compost. That's the perfect material to spread on your lawn. I would worry about the residues in sewage sludge. Certainly, I would never even consider it if I were on well water.
Is this illegal? I'm sorry.
The laws vary from state to state. Every fertilizer has to be approved in every state that it's sold. So sometimes you will see landscapers who even unknowingly may buy a couple of pallet loads of something in Maine on a trip and bring it back to Pennsylvania, and it was perfectly legal to use in Maine, but it's not registered in Pennsylvania. So I don't know the status of this earth life. And there are many people in the recycling business, and even in the pioneers of the organic gardening movement, Jerry Goldstein, who was a longtime editor of Organic Gardening magazine, was a big fan of biosolids. He said, you know, we got to reuse this material somewhere. You know, he was all for trying to clean it up, but that's where we disagreed. I would not use biosolids anywhere near my home. I wouldn't recommend them, whereby I heartily recommend yard waste compost.
All right, sir? I appreciate it very much. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Don't share your indoor space with stink or other bugs. We begin with Al in Oklahoma City, who writes, Mike, what's up with all of these box elder bugs? They took over my backyard. Now they're trying to get into the house. I've never seen so many box elder bugs in my life. Where are they coming from and what can I do? Yes, I realize this is supposed to be about intercepting home-invading stink bugs, and it will be. Keep your garden gloves on. But I'm leading off with Al's box elder bug problem to show that this phenomena, insects trying to move in with us over the winter, is not limited to stinkers alone. In fact, the stink bugs that wreak garden havoc in the Northeast and then try and move indoors with us when the weather cools down are a relatively recent example of this problem. Multicolored Asian ladybugs, conifer seed bugs, and box elder bugs were invading homes long before the current freeloader, the marmorated Asian stink bug, even landed on our shores. All of these insects have the same habit. They seek out safe places to hibernate the winter away in their adult form, typically a cave in their native land. Here, the most convenient cave is your house, and so huge numbers of them begin clustering on the generally south-facing side of homes, especially light-colored homes, beginning in September. The stink bugs we're facing here in Pennsylvania are coming from our gardens. Al's box elder roommates are coming from box elder trees, making them tough to impossible to eradicate. You'd need to cut down every box elder tree within a mile to even make a dent in their numbers. Ah, but they can be trapped as they try to get into your house, and the ones that make it through can be trapped inside. So whatever bug your rent-free tenant may be, follow these plans. They should be equally effective for all unwelcome insects. Which brings us to Polly in Westchester, PA, who writes, Mike, you previously had a gentleman on your show who had devised a trap that would prevent stink bugs from coming into homes for the winter. It was made of cardboard, and the bugs crawled into it. The stinkers are just starting to enter our house. Can you repeat the instructions for making the trap? Well, you're in luck, Polly. That gentleman made it ridiculously easy to grant your request by sending me this email the day after yours. Mike, wanted to let you know that my neighborhood stink bugs have begun their quest of seeking winter hideouts. I've been catching quite a few in my traps already, with the real mother load yet to come. Please remind your listeners to build these traps and reduce the numbers that get into their homes. Jody Williams in Lambertville, New Jersey, www.trapbug.com. Now, as we detailed previously, Jody's trap is simplicity itself. He uses two thick pieces of cardboard, each about the size of an extra-large pizza box, and three long strips of wood, each about 5/16 of an inch thick, to create the size space that stink bugs seem to prefer crawling into, he notes. He staples the three strips of wood lengthwise to the inside of one piece of cardboard, one strip down the center and the other two several inches from each edge. Then he staples the other piece of cardboard over top and hangs it on the outside of his house where the stinkers are gathering. The stink bugs crawl inside in huge numbers. Then once a day he heartily shakes the contents out into a big plastic trash bag, closes the bag quickly, puts it out in the sun to kill the stinkers, and hangs the trap back up. He reports capturing thousands of pests that would otherwise have watched TV inside with him all winter. You'll find step-by-step photos in a great how-to video at Jody's website. That's trapbug.com. And the ones that do get indoors? Well, late this summer, the Rescue brand stink bug trap appeared for sale in supermarkets and home stores. It's a typical insect trap that you fit with pheromone lures so the bugs will enter the trap instead of your tomatoes. And it was designed to be retrofitted with a light instead of those sex lures for indoor use later in the season. And that light assembly is now available at the same stores. It's a fixture containing six cute little LEDs that can be powered by either a wall socket or batteries. The bugs, presumably all kind of bugs, are attracted to the light, enter the trap, and then can't get out. Place it in the attic, basement, or whatever room of your home seems to be their entry point. You can also do it yourself. There are several YouTube videos showing how to make a similar trap using a battery-powered LED fixture in an empty soda bottle. Or get an old table lamp, wrap cardboard around the body of the lamp, and then spray the cardboard with sticky stuff or cover it with double stick tape. bugs attracted to the light will get stuck on the cardboard. When your cardboard is covered with bugs, cut it off and replace it with fresh. Now, although any light will probably do, provided it's the only light source in the room, that's very important, researchers who trap stink bugs in the field report that a black light seems to be the most effective. And I recently noticed several styles of black lights, including one in the shape of a standard compact fluorescent swirly-type bulb in a local home store's party light section. You can have a 60s flashback party and lure stink bugs to their doom, all in one night. Well, those sure were some great tips on preventing and or evicting unwelcome wintertime boarders, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, this and every question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read our excellent advice in detail, with links to lots more info about traps and trap designs, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to trap me with a black light if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please do include your name in the email. Please include your location in the email. Please use the subject in the subject line and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of A to Z garden answers, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Always a welcome winter guest, Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Especially welcome this winter is our brand new intern, Julia Worski. Uh-oh, our editor, Al Banks, seems to be transfixed by that black light. Your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll get you out of there, Al. Don't look at the light, Al. Al, stop looking at the light, Al. I'll see you next week. Spring bulb planting time is almost here. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal when to plant your bulbs and how to protect tulips and other tasty ones from squirrels and other outdoor omnivores. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike can help us to manage and maintain magnificent maple.